Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're an NPR fan, and chances are pretty good that you are, you're probably familiar with the hit NPR podcast, Pop Culture Happy Hour. Aisha Harris is a co-host and reporter for the show, and she's also the author of a debut essay collection. It's called Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. Aisha covers a lot of fascinating ground in her book. For example, she explores the evolution of the black friend trope, all the way from its origins in Taiwan to the Spice Girls during the 90s. She also puts her master's degree in cinema studies from NYU to good use while writing about her work as a film critic. Aisha talked to us about how she has worked through her more existential issues by examining pop culture.
I was someone who grew up in predominantly white spaces, and a lot of my friends, especially in elementary school, were white. And what I wanted to do was really work through both how the black friend has shown up in pop culture and also how, in many ways, I reflected the black friend trope in my own life, specifically when it came to feeling as though my stories were kind of on the back burner, or my whatever I was going through at that moment would be on the back burner with my friends who were white, and having those conversations where I felt as though I was just there to sort of be the sidekick or the sounding board, and not really feel like I was living my own story or the lead character in my own story. And so that was kind of one of the things that I really wanted to work through, was how I created my own version of the black best friend and how I had to eventually move away from it in a way that pop culture in some ways is moving away from this trope in interesting ways, but is also still reinforcing them in other ways.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned moving away from this trope. So did you have to, I'm just curious how this played out once you realized you were serving as a surrogate black friend, so to speak. Did you have to find new friends or find a new way to, so that you would get to tell your stories in front of these white friends? How did that work out?
Well, I mean, I think it worked out itself out sort of naturally. Eventually, I made friends who were not white, who were, of other ethnicities and backgrounds. And we could commiserate in some ways over the ways we sometimes felt in white spaces. But then also when I went to college, I was able to be exposed to even more black people who were not my family, and be able to really sort of like feel comfortable in those spaces with other black people and feel that community. And then, I still have, of course, plenty of white friends, but they're the type of friends now that I can feel comfortable actually talking about politics and race with in a way that when I was younger, I was just not equipped to do. And so I think really just part of it is just growing up and really having my horizons expanded.
That's great that you don't have to feel that way anymore. One of the assumptions that bothers you as a black film critic is the belief that all black artists should be exempt from negativity. Can you explain that?
Part of being a critic of anything, like regardless of your background, is that people are going to, not agree with you because criticism is, of course, something that is subjective and we all have our different opinions. But I think as a Black critic, there's an extra layer of scrutiny and a sort of tension that exists when you are reviewing Black art that I don't think exists in other cases. And that is that, like, you have to sort of, because we've had so many examples of terrible representation in film and TV, and there's still a long way to go and we still have issues, but there's this expectation that we should not be too harsh on the Black art that we don't like. And I think that that comes from this scarcity mindset that has its roots in real history of there being scarcity. But as I argue in the book, I really wanted to point out that we are in this really flourishing time of Black art in the mainstream and on the outskirts, where we have all of these creators, people like Barry Jenkins, Ava DuVernay, Issa Rae, who are really kind of expanding what Blackness can look like on film and TV. And it's no longer just one person. It's no longer all on the shoulders of Sidney Poitier or Harry Belafonte or Ruby Dee. Like, we have so much more. And so I think that because we also have so much more, there's also some of it is not going to be great. Some of it is not going to be good even. And I don't think there's anything wrong with pointing that out. But there are some people who get upset if you do. And I think that to me, it's really important to be able to talk about Black art and really wrestle with it, not just as to whether it's good or bad representation, but also, is it a good movie? Is it entertaining? Is it aesthetically pleasing? I want to treat Black art seriously, and that means sometimes being critical of it in ways that people might not like.
Yeah, very well said. You have to deal with a lot of comments from what you call WFBT, White Film Bro Twitter. Can you quickly define White Film Bro Twitter for us and then let us know how you handle that?
Right. It comes from both sides, right? I'll get it from Black people who are upset with my criticism. Then there are, of course, like the White Film Bro Twitter in many ways embodies a very particular kind of criticism or belief in how film should be. Paul Schrader comes to mind. But look, Paul Schrader, the filmmaker, is someone who I admire deeply. He's made some of the greatest films of the last like 40 or 50 years, including he wrote Taxi Driver, he recently directed First Reformed. When the Sight and Sound list, this most recent Sight and Sound list, which comes out every 10 years, was announced, and it had the most amount of non-white and non-male filmmakers represented on the list, people like Paul Schrader were very upset about quote-unquote wokeism taking over these like cultural institutions that had been historically mostly white, or at least not directors of color outside of, you know, Asia, were not really heavily represented. It's this very kind of one-track mind way of thinking about film and film criticism, and this idea that only white men can make great movies. And I think that that's something you have to deal with a lot of times, and it's frustrating. But there's also a very robust non-white film bro Twitter, and there are plenty of white film critics who are not like that.
A few years ago, you had some difficulty writing a review of Ava DuVernay's adaptation of A Wrinkle in Time. Can you tell us about what that experience was like for you?
Yeah, I've always admired her work, and I still do. But that movie presented a challenge for me because I didn't like it. Mm-hmm. And the other challenge was that she was the first Black woman of color even to direct a $100 million movie. So there was a lot at stake, ostensibly at stake, for that movie. And again, that scarcity mindset of, well, if this movie bombs, is, you know, they're not going to give the opportunity again to another woman of color to direct a movie this big. That's a real fear. But I also think, again, you have to stay true to the work and true to how you respond to it. And my duty, I feel, as a critic, is to be as honest about how a movie hits me as possible. And so with that movie, I really struggled because I didn't want to trash this movie because I respected her, and also because of that scarcity. But I also wound up realizing, you know, I have to be honest about this. I don't think my little review at the time did anything to harm the movie's box office. It was going to do what it was going to do. And most of the critiques of that movie were kind of middling.
Mm-hmm, definitely. How do white critics and viewers misinterpret, dismiss, and belittle Black artistry?
You know, I think a big part of it is just not being familiar with Black filmmakers outside of the handful of ones that have broken through to the mainstream. I think it's less true today than it was, 5-10 years ago. But there was a time when it was like Spike Lee and Tyler Perry. That's what critics at least would consider to be Black art. And so in the book, I refer to a review that was in Variety a few years back for the movie Girls Trip, the very raucous, fun, R-rated comedy. The reviewer, who is a white male, compared it to Tyler Perry movie. And if you're familiar at all with a Tyler Perry movie, they are very conservative, very kind of, there's a lot of religion involved, and there's never going to be, you know, characters who are in sexual situations that are played for laughs. You know, that doesn't happen. And so for that reviewer to sort of like automatically go toward Tyler Perry as a comparison revealed to me that they're not steeped in Black film history and understand that. And I think that's a common mistake that happens with reviewers of any movies or TV shows that are kind of outside of maybe their cultural knowledge. And I think it's important as critics to really educate ourselves as much as possible when we are reviewing things that might be out of our comfort zone. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do that. I just think we need to be very careful and very respectful.
Yeah. Let's rewind to 2013. You're 25 years old and you're working as a writer at Slate, and it's around the holidays and visions of Santa Claus's race are dancing in your head. What did you do?
We were pitching ideas for potential holiday-themed articles, and I thought about how growing up, there was always a Black Santa in my household, but I never really saw Black Santas outside of that. I thought, what if instead of Santa Claus being a human, he could just be a penguin? Because everyone loves penguins. It's an animal. And little kids, regardless of their background, don't have to wonder, oh, why doesn't Santa look like me? I wrote that article and, you know, I meant it as a sort of tongue-in-cheek. I didn't actually think we were suddenly going to switch to making Santa a penguin. Megyn Kelly, who was at the time still at Fox News, did a whole segment on it and it went viral. And It was a little wild.
In Slate, they have a piece on .com, Santa Claus should not be a white man anymore. And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is. And just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
It was really interesting to see how much people really reacted to it and how upset some people were and how happy they were about, you know, my point of view. And I really connected to the fact that 10 years later now, it feels like maybe things have gotten worse. And we have so many people, especially conservatives, complaining about things being too woke just because suddenly there are Black and Asian people in Star Wars, or The Little Mermaid is now Black in the remake of that film. I do think that especially in America, we cling so heavily to mythology and traditional, quote unquote, traditional representations in our, you know, history, but also in our pop culture. And I really wish we could sort of be open to being more malleable in terms of what are fictional, mind you, these are all fictional characters, Santa Claus and all the Star Wars characters, be mindful of them being open to change, because change is good. And I think everything should morph in certain ways and evolve in different ways beyond what we are traditionally used to seeing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. How did you react when your piece went viral?
I'm not an extrovert in most ways, despite the fact that I have like a sort of public facing job. It was a little overwhelming just because it was the most viral I'd ever gone for a piece that I wrote. Still is, I think, to this day. You know, it was really surreal seeing it turned into an SNL sketch.
This week, Fox News host Megyn Kelly sparked controversy when she said, quote, kids, Santa is white. And just because it makes you feel uncomfortable doesn't mean it has to change. Here with his comments is Santa Claus.
Hey! Hello, everyone. Merry Christmas. Hello, Cecily.
Wow, you're Santa.
That's right. I guess the truth is out. You heard a secret Santa. Well, here's a secret for you. I'm black as hell.
It was just very weird. It just shocked me that people would be so upset about this fictional character who's not real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very strange and surreal. What did you learn about yourself from writing Wannabe?
I learned that I am still evolving and still very much a work in progress as to how I interact with pop culture. It's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of big-ish life lessons that I detail throughout the book, including my ideas around sex and gender and masculinity and this idea of wanting to be the sort of female version of a man in the most like narrowly defined ways. What I've learned is that like I really do use pop culture as like a way of learning more about myself, and that it's okay to evolve and it's okay to change my perspective on things. And in fact, it might be really great to be able to do that. And I think it's actually a good thing. One of the quotes I use is from Roger Ebert, where he talks about returning to La Dolce Vita at different periods in his life and realizing something new or identifying with a different character in a different way each time. And the fact that like movies and TV shows, like they hit us where we are, wherever we are at that time. And when they stay the same, but we always change. And when we return to them, we are always a slightly different person than who we were before. I think that's to me just the joy of being able to write about and cover pop culture is just being able to change my mind about things.
Mm. Aisha Harris, thank you very much for joining us today. And congratulations on Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. It's a very entertaining and very enlightening book.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Aisha Harris is the co-host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour and the author of Wannabe, Reckonings with the Pop Culture That Shapes Me. Find out more about Aisha and Wannabe at WPR.org/beta.
As dark as, you know, Mulholland Drive is, and some of David Lynch's cinema really is, that there is this sort of optimism.
Coming up, director Alexander Philippe joins us to talk about his latest documentary, Lynch Oz. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.